Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm Leslie B., and this is The Path to Authenticity.
If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity. It is Saturday, July 11th, 2020. At this point, we have right around 136,000 Americans who we've lost to COVID-19. And I live in South Florida, which is, you know, a mess right now with the infection rate. So, God, I hope it starts to get better soon. It's been a really rough year for us. This is episode 77, and it features a conversation with a woman named Leslie Barabas. And, you know, it's interesting. I've mentioned on the show a number of times, I found a lot of guests on Instagram, and sometimes it's just their username, their handle that will intrigue me and lead me to look at their profile and check out the work that they do. And that's what happened with Leslie, who is at Jungian Love Coach. So she is a love coach, and her work is greatly influenced by the work of Carl Jung. So if you don't know about Carl Jung, he was a protege of Sigmund Freud. A lot of his work is around the unconscious and the collective unconscious. Really mystical, spiritual guy. Very, very influential thinker. And those of us who are invested in 12-step philosophy, if it wasn't for Carl Jung, there probably never would have been an Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a doctor who one of the co-founders of AA worked with during the time that he was struggling and trying to learn how to be a sober man. And so he definitely figures prominently in the history of the 20th century. So we had quite a conversation. It went deep real fast, and I could have spoken to her much longer if I didn't have other commitments that afternoon. And I definitely want her to come back to be on the show again. She's bright, articulate. And so I hope you're as entertained by listening to this as I was by having the conversation. So here you go. Leslie B. How's your day going?
It's going well. We're having a little bit of a Santa Ana here in San Diego, so we have the AC cranked, but all is well.
So when you say Santa Ana, are we talking about the Santa Ana winds, or what is that?
That's a great point. I have always known, since I've been in California for 20 years, I've always known Santa Ana to mean heat. Okay. So I believe it is winds, because there's often fires that start when there's Santa Ana's because of the wind blowing.
Right.
Which is, yep, Yep. So good point. But I always just associate it with heat.
When I hear Santa Ana, I think John Steinbeck. So tell everybody what you do.
Well, I'm a love coach. And do you want me to talk about how I do love coaching? So, geez.
Well, how did you become a love coach? What led you to that?
Great question. I would say most of my adult life, meaning starting around 18 years old, you know, first high school heartbreak, up until 20s and 30s, so a couple decades, it was just a, more or less, it was a struggle. And it was a lot of ups and downs, just trying to find what I believed I wanted in a relationship. And that changed and evolved with my age, of course, but it didn't become easier. If anything, well, I wouldn't say it became harder because, you know, heartbreak at 18 is intense.
Yes, yes, yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's just different, I guess. We become a little bit more embittered, but we also start to know ourselves more. And so things not working out, or as much as we know intellectually, we still can't find that relationship, becomes more perplexing probably because it doesn't make sense, because now we're not just young and naive, we're older and wiser, but yet still on the roller coaster at a different sort of stage. So it was that struggle that led me to, well, actually my first book, I don't know if you're familiar with Louise Hay.
Yeah.
She wrote You Can Heal Your Life, and that was my first book at 18 years old. And I went on to read probably hundreds more spiritual, you know, in the same genre, a lot of Wayne Dyer, Deepak Chopra, Marianne Williamson. I think I read them all. And it was just sort of this quest to figure it out. Mm-hmm. You know, is it me? Is it them? Like, whatever it is, I want to just figure it out so I can accomplish what I want, or I can attain what I want. I've always been sort of a hopeless romantic. Mm-hmm. And as much as those books were uplifting and wonderful, and they had a lot of robust wisdom, the fact is it didn't change anything for me. Mm. My life didn't change. I mean, temporarily, it was like a boost. It was like almost like a drug. Like you get like a hit of things being all as well, but not in a lasting way. So I kind of then went to, I guess, I don't know if it's an opposite extreme, but I would take the classes, or of course, it started with Cosmopolitan magazine, like all the articles about, you know, how to catch a guy and how to keep his interest. And I mean, it was endless, this endless stream of how to contort yourself into something that you're not in order to be what you think the opposite sex is going to want, or the same sex, depending on, you know, what you're attracted to.
Right.
And that didn't change anything either. I actually took some courses. I won't name any names, but these are, you know, sort of well-known experts in the dating and relationship world. And again, it was more it was more robust than just an article in Cosmo. There was more to it. But again, the overarching themes were act like this, pretend to be that, make sure you look like this, and don't ever be yourself. Mm. And make sure you don't put too much pressure on your dates when you're dating. Act mysterious because, you know, men don't like women who are available. So you have to like keep up this facade, really. And
I hate all that stuff. I really do. The game.
Yeah, the game. Yep, exactly right. And I know men deal with it too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, personally, in, you know, I'm a single guy. I mean, it's pretty obvious when someone you're dating is doing something because they think that's what they're supposed to do. Like, you know, when you really connect with someone, but you can tell they're holding back because they think maybe that's what they've been taught they're supposed to do in order to have the kind of relationship they want. I don't know, but this is the path to authenticity for a reason, because, you know, I hate all that stuff. It's just such a pain, you know? And, I'll tell you, I don't know how I first saw you on Instagram or when, but it's been a while that I've been following you, and the fact that you're not only a love coach, but you're a Jungian love coach is what really stood out to me. So I kind of think I see where this story's going, or I can imagine.
Because you know Jung's work.
A little bit, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well,
it's quite different.
What's that?
It's quite different.
It is. But you know, what I have learned myself, because the way I kid around that I was looking for a wife when I was 14 years old, you know, like I just always thought what I wanted was a permanent relationship. And I was super serious with just about, with everyone I ever really dated. I mean, if it went anywhere, man, I took it to the extreme, you know? I think I have known for a long time, because I've done a lot of personal inquiry too. I think I knew that I was like, reenacting something or trying to resolve something inside, but it took me a long time to understand how, and it took me a long time to actually work through it and get to the other side where I didn't do that stuff anymore. And I think in reading some of the materials you sent me to prepare for this, you know, I think you basically drew the same conclusion I did, which I think we hear about a lot, is that, you know, you have to love yourself before you can really love anyone else or be available for anyone else to love. So the stuff about people telling you not to do this and not to do that and don't be yourself, that just kind of breaks my heart. That so many people get those messages.
Yes. Yes. Me, the great way of framing that. It is heartbreaking that people, and I was that person that bought that message too, oh, this is what I have to do. And didn't see, you know, we don't know what we don't and what we don't know.
Right.
So, and as you said, you know, Jung refers to, I mean, the crux of his work is individuation.
Right.
And most of us, Tom, don't wake up in the morning and say, I want to individuate. Right?
Right.
We have to have like a carrot. There has to be a carrot dangling that we're, and it's that desire to get married. It's a desire for a relationship. It's a desire, ... fill in the blank.
Maybe not to suffer anymore or whatever.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that is what starts the journey through the Cosmopolitan magazine articles and the spiritual books and the self-development programs and the dating workshops, that then all of a sudden for me, you know, you finally 20 years later stumble over a talk on Jungian psychology, and and then the rest is history. But
did it blow your mind when you found that?
It still does.
Yeah.
It still blows my mind. Yeah. It is just such a different approach than anything else I've ever read or heard about. And it's a process. It's never done. There's never the day where we're like, okay, I'm going to put my pencil down. I'm done. I'm glad I got through that. No, it's going to be a lifelong application. And that's going to turn some people away from it because they're not up for that. Mm-hmm. Like, they want the quick fix. They want I just want it now. Just, can you just give me some kind of shortcut? And this process, this work isn't for them, because that's not
right.
That's not what this is. Yeah.
So
it is a journey. Yeah.
How, when you say that's not what this is, what is it? What would you say it is for someone who's listening and doesn't know anything about Jungian psychology?
Well, it's a process of understanding the nature of reality. And I know that doesn't sound related to dating and relationships, but it truly is. And what I mean by the nature of reality, Jung, as you know, incorporated a lot of Eastern philosophy into his work in the 30s and 40s. And you know, he worked under Freud. And Freud was really the one that came up with the idea of the subconscious, right? As this repository of thoughts, memories, and ideas, assumptions, and beliefs that we're not aware of. It's just in this compartment that's locked. Jung took it to a totally different direction, as you know, with the archetypes and everything. But the idea is that the nature of reality, it has the appearance that we get things, or we create our life through our thoughts, our actions, and our attitude, basically, right? That's how we're taught from the day we are born, pretty much. This is how you create in your life. You take a lot of action. You have to positive thinking. You hear a lot about positive thinking. And you have to have your head, your mindset has to be in the right place. What Jung presented is that it's exactly the opposite, that we're creating unconsciously. And so it's the thoughts that we have are arising from the unconscious mind. And so those thoughts are driving our actions, and those actions are producing some kind of result. And we consider that result either good or bad, depending on who we are and what we're looking for. And that result, we place a judgment on it that conditions our future behavior in the world. And this is the reason why people consciously say, I want X, Y, and Z. I want a relationship where I'm mutually loved and appreciated and adored, and it's stable, and they can tell you all these things that they consciously want about a relationship, but the results that they're getting are people that are unavailable, people that don't want to commit, people that slip away. So this is exactly what, and it's very hard to summarize Jung, but essentially his work was that you will see your unconscious mind in your results.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're wondering, if you're single and you want a relationship and you're sitting in your living room listening to this and you're saying, well, what's in my unconscious mind? Well, what is your current status? What's your current result? Well, I'm single. Okay. So there's some unconscious idea or unconscious assumption or belief that you're better off being single, that being single is serving you. And it is. You just don't know how it is.
Mm.
And that's what you're creating. And people aren't creating it on purpose, obviously, mm-hmm. right? We don't create this on purpose, but we are creating it. And when I started to see how I was unavailable and how I was pushing people away, which I promise you, I did not see that.
Right.
I only saw what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
It was everyone else's fault.
Right. Well, that's what we do, right? In general.
Yes.
I mean, we project it onto someone else.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And when you go through this process, when you do this work and you start to get just little glimpses of how you're contributing, I'll just be fair, you're contributing to the relationship status, the condition of your relationship, where it goes. It's like, I almost fell off my chair the first time I mm-hmm. got a glimpse of that. So you mentioned projection, and we can't talk about the unconscious without talking about the ego, right? Because the ego is what created the unconscious. It created the content in the unconscious, right? So one of the major defense mechanisms of the ego is projection.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you understand this, you know, throughout our development, from when we're 2 years old, and the newest research even suggests that the highest impact on our unconscious happens between being born and three, actually. Mm-hmm. But I believe, you know, the formative years were generally like two-ish when they start developing the I, like the mm-hmm. recognizing that I'm separate.
Right.
From my mother, and I'm separate in the world, and it's all about me, me, me. The ego, you know, we learn what we have to do to survive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, every child needs and wants the affection and love of the parent, right? Regardless of how the parent is treating them,
right.
They need and want the love and affection and approval. So in the family unit, which is our first exposure, there's lots of messages about what is good and what is bad. And we learn the word no. And so anything as we grow up in the family unit, and then later, you know, we go to school, we're amongst our peers, and we're learning other things about what's acceptable behavior, what behavior is denounced, and so forth. That's developing shadow, because whatever we judge or whatever we're taught is good, and I'm putting good in quotes,
mm-hmm.
bad is to be avoided.
Right.
So an example could be, you know, a mom drops her little girl off at the first day of first grade, you know, 5 years old or whatever. And this little girl's crying because she doesn't want to be away from the mother. And so let's just say some kids start laughing at her because she's crying, and they're pointing at her and making fun of her because, oh, you're crying, you need your mom. Any child that observes that, depending on how they interpret it, right?
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. could think, ooh, I better not cry because I'm not going to make it around here. Like,
right, right.
I need to fit in.
Well, and, I need to be loved, and I won't be lovable if I cry or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, and it's the same thing. Approval, love, fitting mm-hmm. in, being included. So it's in it, each child could interpret that situation differently. So let's just use one out of hundreds and hundreds of examples could be, you know, I gotta be strong.
Right.
Like I have to just stuff it. If someone hurts my feelings, I'm not gonna cry. And 20 years later, that 25-year-old is annoyed by people who cry or
right.
appear weak. Mm. And they don't know why.
Yeah.
It's just, it's because it's an idea that was observed and that weakness was put in the shadow because it was the ego saw it as this will not allow you to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so what does the ego do with the shadow contents? It projects, and that's the way it gets rid of it. To say, that's not me. You know, you know, my, whatever the, I mean, you can go on and on with these ideas, whatever the, you know, the family unit impressed upon us was good or bad. Those are all polarizing judgments that we then see everywhere in the world. So Jung was a pioneer really in psychology because he said, we have to integrate these two, this duality within us that I have to be good. So the ego, you know, formed a persona based on what it thought it would help us survive, right? Mm-hmm. And the persona is just the way we interact in the world, the way we want people to see us, the way we think of ourselves. And later on when we're dating, I mean, if you look at someone's dating profile, there's the persona. Mm-hmm. Everything you want that person wants you to think about them or see in them is on that profile. Or your resume or whatever. And there's all this, the opposite, right? So the person who interprets sadness, crying, weakness as dangerous, right? This is not mm-hmm. going to allow me to survive, be loved, fit in, could develop a persona of, I'm tough. You know, you can't, you're mm-hmm. not going to make me cry. And in the shadow of that person, in the unconscious, the person, so the shadow is the personal unconscious, is all this softness and sadness and mm-hmm. emotional sensitivity because it's been pushed down. So if you think about it, it's exhausting, right? Because we're constantly upholding the persona or the mm-hmm. ego is constantly upholding it. And in order to do that, has to push the opposite aspect down.
Mm-hmm.
And what Jung said is, you know, we're living in a dualistic world. There is, as much as we, the human race, would love everything to be peaceful and wonderful and everyone's treated fairly and there's no violence and there's no poverty and there's no tragedy, this is not life.
Mm-hmm.
Life is full of duality. There's the lightness and darkness. There's mm-hmm. day and night. There's neutrons or protons and electrons, right? Mm-hmm. Neutrons wouldn't. But, and if we try to go through life being what we consider to be good
mm-hmm.
and denying all these repressed parts of ourselves. We're living a lie, essentially. Mm. And also we're living asleep because so when you talked earlier, you know, in the call about self-love, and you hear a lot about love yourself, what does that mean? How?
Yeah. And it's confusing, isn't it? Like it's, yeah. It's,
it is until you study Jung.
Mm.
And he's really the only one. And there were other depth psychiatrists, don't get me wrong, mm-hmm. but he was the one that gave us a map to the self. Like, you want to know how to love yourself truly, so that it, you know, here's the map.
Mm-hmm.
And it really starts with people, first of all, acknowledging that they have an ego, because some people are like, what? I have an ego? I thought that was just like a narcissist term, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then looking at their persona, which is like, how do I want my date to see me? How do I want this person that I'm in this new relationship? How do I want them to see? What do I want them to see about me? And then what do I hide mm-hmm. about myself? What do I worry that if someone sees this, they're going to run? And those, that's still conscious, right? Because we're aware of the things we're hiding. The unconscious is all about the things that we're unaware that we're hiding. And it's by design that we can't see it. So the psyche, I don't know if you've ever looked up the definition of psyche, means soul.
Mm.
And so it's a function that helps us survive, just like our physical organs, like your mm-hmm. heart is beating blood through, you know, systemically through your system to, you know, feed oxygenated blood to your organs, and your liver is processing toxins, and your kidneys are filtering and doing every part of you has a function in keeping you alive. And Jung's work was about saying, yes, we need that. We absolutely need that. There's no need to denounce the ego. It is the reason you are here right now. Mm. It is the reason you learned early on, like, if I want to have friends, if I want to be included in the tribe, I need to brush my teeth. I have to comb my hair. I have to put clothes on. Because with the ego that's not functioning properly, such as in, you know, certain disorders like schizophrenia, there's that function is impaired. And that's why they don't brush their hair. They don't care.
Right.
There's no desire to fit in. So it's really not something we need to like obliterate. It's helped us survive, but he says around midlife, whatever that means. And what does that mean today versus 100 years ago,
mm-hmm.
you know, when Jung's was teaching this? And, you know, different individuals. But generally speaking, he said, I believe 30 years old was kind of the point at which in life, okay, you know you can survive. You've proven it to yourself. You're still here. So do you want the rest of your life to be about surviving? Just surviving, like a little squirrel or a little bird? Or do you want to experience expansion?
Mm-hmm.
And do you want to experience really more of who you really are beyond the ego? Because the way he described it, you know, the ego is just the tip of the iceberg. And below that tip is the rest of you. It's so vast. And this is where he talks about the process, not of going externally, but internally. And so what I realized in studying, this was a process of several years, and I would have one aha moment after the next. But I mean, essentially, we create by going within. And it's so counterintuitive when you tell people this, because the senses are telling us otherwise, right? Everything's the senses, like taste, touch, smell, our physicality of the experience of being human is constantly pulling you outside. The carrot's out there. It's in that big house. It's in the perfect marriage. It's in the perfect relationship. It's in the car. It's in the bank account. But you really have to get those things to then realize, like, oh, wait, I'm still unhappy. Damn.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah. And so I've been talking for a while. I want to stop and ask if you have any questions.
No, this has been fantastic. I mean,
okay, good.
No, and one of the things that I try to focus on for this podcast is obstacles to our own authenticity. You know, and one of those obstacles is, you know, what you were just talking about is, I guess, constantly looking outside of ourselves for the answers, the solutions, the satisfaction when it's within.
Yeah.
It really is within. We really already have the answers. And, you know, it's funny because a lot of what you said, I mean, I could relate to it so much. And a lot of the work that I've been doing myself over the last 10 years. Well, first of all, a divorce was a big catalyst for me going layers deeper and into, you know, self discovery. And so and that's when I started to see how I keep repeating these things, because, you know, someone gets divorced, you know, the first thought is, well, I'll never do that again. And then the next relationship was more painful than the divorce, you know, I mean, and what I was withholding myself, you know, I was not showing every part of myself. I was withholding the shadow parts that I thought would, you know, lead me to, create an abandonment, you know, when actually what happened is the fact that I held back everything that I did created the abandonment, because how can someone love you if they don't even know who you are? It's right. Not possible.
Right.
And one of the things that really kind of hit home is, you know, you're talking about crying. With me personally, it was more about sadness. I got this overt message as a kid, unspoken rule that, like, man, if you're sad, you will be devoured, destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me so long to figure that out. And so then what do you do when you have that unconscious belief that, you know, you'll lose everything if you're sad? I mean, you repress the sadness. And, yep. You know, the duality, if we can't experience sadness, then, you know, we have no reference point by which to experience joy. We don't get to just numb ourselves from the emotions that we want to numb ourselves from, you know, but, and then for me, like tapping into that sadness and experiencing it and allowing myself to go there a little bit at a time and working through it and getting to the other side just made all the difference, you know?
Yes. And the reason that is because emotions are, well, Jung called emotions, he called it psychological energy. So when it's the resistance of to feeling the emotions, resisting those, keeping it down, suppressing them requires a great deal of energy.
Right.
So when, okay, so I'm just going to give you an analogy on the emotion. So I do my workout that I found like 8 years ago. It's called Bar Method. And it's based on isometrics and dance, ballet. The point is, it's a very targeted workout. So when you're in a, let's just say the session where you're working out your legs, the pain is so intense, you want to scream. I mean, it hurts like hell. But if you just give up and get out of the position and say that hurts, you know, I'm not doing that. Well, you're not going to transform that muscle. Right. That muscle needs that resistance to transform. And so what do? You just embrace the pain. You literally embrace. I mean, this, I'm using Bar Method. You can apply this to weightlifting. You can apply it to running. It's like, it's not comfortable, but you allow that feeling of discomfort, sometimes really intense discomfort, to be there until you're done with your run.
Right.
And you don't let it stop you. And emotions are the single most powerful conditioning agents there are. Because, as you said, you know, a feeling, whatever that feeling was that you felt, I'm not going to put a label on it, but, you know, after your divorce or after the relationship, after your divorce, it is instinctual for you to act in a way that avoids feeling that again. And I would even wonder if after your divorce, you, as you said, you went into that next relationship with almost like a hesitation. Like you weren't really opening up, and you knew you weren't really opening up. And it's because you're consciously saying, I want a relationship that's going to last, that's successful, where I'm happy and the other person's happy. Unconsciously, it's like, ooh, I don't know if that's a good idea. So your question was about obstacles, though. Did you have a specific question? Because I can talk about obstacles.
Well, I mean, I didn't necessarily have a question, but, you know, I just see our inclination to look outside of ourselves as being the obstacle.
Oh, I see. Yeah, it's a distraction for sure.
Well, and also there's an obstacle in the tendency to recreate these things, you know, the very things that we're avoiding, you know?
Yes, sir.
Because that for me was, you know, I'm an addictions counselor. That's kind of what my day job is. And so I do a lot of coaching and working with clients and people who, I mean, so many of us just keep doing the same thing over and over and over again, even though we don't intend to.
Yep.
And that is so frustrating. Because it's like, okay, I intellectually know better than to do this, but I keep doing it anyway. Why?
Yes.
You know, and then there's the guilt and shame over that. Like I'm supposed to be healthier than this or whatever. And, or I know better, smarter, whatever. But, you know, really for me, it was about like you talked about, I don't know if you use the word adapt, but that's the word I use. Like in my childhood, you know, I at some point started to gain the consciousness where I could go back and look at, okay, this is how I adapted to avoid the sadness, or this is how I adapted to not lose the favor of the people around me, or not lose the attention of the people around me, or whatever it was. You know, we adapt, and it's instinctive to keep the love that we have or whatever, you know, and then that sets the tone for how we go through life. And really, like, if we're rejected by a parent or we didn't get enough attention from a parent, then, you know, I mean, a lot of us keep trying to get it. We just don't know it, that that's what we're trying to. And so for me, what I would do is eventually, I mean, I was choosing unavailable people until like yesterday. You know, I mean, like it's really only in the last few years that I've gotten to the point where the people who are unavailable actually repel me rather than attract me. And I think it's because I was trying to resolve this, you know, this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You're absolutely right. About adapting. And I just did a little tiny little like 3-minute sort of video on rejection. And I talk about how, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago, if someone didn't like you and you were pushed out of the tribe,
you'd die.
Right? You would die. Yeah. because you would have no access to food, shelter, or water, or warmth. And so the instinct that you're talking about to adapt is survival.
Right.
It's survival. And it's the same instinct that we have to win the love and approval of the parents, because we can't survive without them. Mm. We need them to, and the child knows, and I work, you know, when I work with private clients, advanced private clients, we go into who the power parent was, because every child knows. They don't know intellectually, right? But they know, like, this is the one I need to survive. This one's going to feed me, and right? And so if there's conflict with the power parent, then the child will often, they don't like the abuse or the neglect, obviously, or the abandonment or whatever is the child's interpreting or whatever the events are, but they still need and want the approval and love from the parent, even when there is abuse. Mm-hmm. So this, of course, creates conflict, and that conflict leads to, you know, young talks about complexes. Mm. And so this is shaping very, very early on. It's creating an imprint of who we're attracted to. And it's based on that relationship. Mm. And when we're adults, it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
But here's the thing. If you attract someone who is showing you love and openly affectionate with you and calls you all the time and just like all over you, just can't wait to hang out and be together all the time, you're like, ugh. Like if that wasn't love to you, then that's going to be weird. It's just going to freak you out,
right?
Because that's not, because whatever that initial relationship was with the parent, it is what a kid considers normal. Mm. They don't know anything else.
Yeah.
So we just grow up. And then, of course, there's other early friendships, siblings that sort of contribute to that imprint, that sort of shape it as we go along. But it's the reason why we want a certain relationship. But it's like the reality is what you're saying. Why do I keep doing the same thing? God, I know better. It's because there's an unconscious drive. There's you're not aware of it. But a person who is, let's just say, perpetually attracted to unavailable people, they don't want to be close. Unconsciously, there's an idea that that's dangerous.
Right.
Or it's too risky, or it's just not safe, and you're better off just staying at a distance. So you're not thinking that.
Right.
But remember, unconscious, what we pick up from other people, I forget the percentages, but it's like talking in language is some small percentage what we're communicating.
Yeah, body language is a lot.
Yes, body language is posture, it's eye contact, it's tiny little micro movements in the face, it's lots of things that you're not thinking that you're picking up, but you are picking it up.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we meet somebody and we're unavailable, but we don't know we're unavailable, right? But we are, let's just say, because we haven't done this work. And we meet someone in a bar or just on a first date or whatever, we're going to pick up. And honestly, Tom, people will more often than not tell you on the first date that they're not available.
Right.
But we'll ignore that.
Right.
And we will pick up everything that this is the unconscious desire. And desire is such a wrong word to use because you don't want that.
Right.
But unconsciously, there's an idea that this is going to keep you safe and you're better off, right? So that's what I mean by desire. But you're going to pick up all those signals that this person isn't available, and there's going to be all this explosive chemistry. And then people are going to come to me and they're going to say, I don't know what it is. I always have so much chemistry for guys that, or girls, that aren't interested in me. And the ones that are available and they call me all the time, I'm not interested in. I feel nothing for them because there's a way I can force myself to feel something for the people that are actually good to me. And the answer is, you're, as long as your attraction is unconscious, this will not change.
Mm.
You have to make it conscious. When you make it conscious, then you will have different chemistry. And this type of person will no longer be attractive to you.
Mm. And so this brings me to what you have in the signature of your email and I have on the back of my business card. Until we make the unconscious conscious, it will rule your life and you will call it fate.
Yes.
Isn't that amazing?
It is.
Yeah.
It's profound.
Mm-hmm.
And you said something earlier too, when you were talking about your divorce or the relationship after that, I forget your exact words, but something about like, you didn't want to look at it. And none of us want to look at it. And Jung spent 20 years on the Red Book, which is my husband bought me as a gift like 5 years ago. It's in my office. And this was all that the entire, you know, premise is the unconscious and how, you know, it presents a moral dilemma for the ego to look at the contents of the unconscious. Because remember, our ego developed our persona based on survival, based on this trait will help you survive, this one won't.
Mm-hmm.
So be like this and don't be like that. God, do not be like that. And right. then we see those people and we're like, oh, I can't stand yes, that person.
Yes, yes.
Right? Like, oh, it's just so triggering.
Yeah.
And that's all it, the bigger the trigger for us, or I should say, like, the more polarizing it is, the more energy we're using to, like, we need to take a, like, a tiny little dose of that and incorporate it into a, like, integrate it into who we're being and who mm-hmm. we're allowing ourselves to be. Because if we don't, we're just split all the time. We're just, I have to be good and I can't be bad, and I have to be like this, but I can't be like that. When we start to integrate those dark, awful, disgusting ideas about ourselves, that, like, these traits, so Jung said, these traits are in all of us. Mm-hmm. They're in all of us. And the more we deny them, the more we're going to see them out there in the external world. You're going to see them in the people you date. You're going to see them in the people you marry. And until you, again, make it conscious, it's going to run you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like you're the golf ball being hit around the course rather than the swing, being the swinger of the club. Right. And, you know, it presents a moral dilemma for us to do this work, because those elements, they're in the unconscious. Why? Because the ego said they're not going to, you won't survive.
Yeah.
You won't survive if you're like this. Nobody's going to love you and you're going to die alone. Right? Mm-hmm. So when we do this work and I say to a client, okay, let's do some shadow work, they're, what happens? The defenses go way up. The ego's like, oh no.
Right.
No, 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 no. I have done work for the last 20, 30, 40, 50 plus years, keeping these plates spinning. You are not. Yeah.
You're not going to ruin this.
Yeah. Yep.
Well,
so that's, yeah.
I could, like, do this forever. I want you to come back on. Honestly, will you come back on another time?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well,
I've just scratched the surface, Tom.
No, I know. And it just, I love this stuff. And one of the things that I believe that I'm really grateful for is that I do love this stuff. I'm intrigued by all of this because I think, you know, people who suffer and who have problems in life and need help. I mean, I think it's harder to get better if you're not inquisitive in this way. I know it has served me well to be willing to go inward and to be fascinated by it. And I am, really. And this has been great. I mean, and I know we only did scratch the surface. This could have been, like, the longest episode I've ever had. And I've had some long conversations that I've ended up splitting into a couple different episodes. But yeah, no, I would love to have you come back. But before you go, I want to ask you if there was a time in your life when you could go back and the younger Leslie needed a word of advice, when would that have been and what would you say?
Mm-hmm. It's such a great question. And knowing what I know now, there's nothing I could have said to my younger self because I wasn't ready for this work. I wasn't ready to receive the message. So mm-hmm. it's this kind of introspection really, really requires people to be ready. Mm-hmm. And someone can pour this on your head, and if you're not ready for it, it's just not going to resonate. They'll just say, yeah, I don't know what that's about. Yeah, no, I'm not very interested in that. Or it just, yeah, I don't really get it, or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's very much the same thing that the person that you're searching for, you know, if you want to call it a soulmate or your ideal partner or whatever, they're there. They are there. You just can't see them until you're ready to see them. So I wish so much, though, that I had this knowledge when I was younger, because I would have saved myself so much pain. And but I really had to go through everything that I went through to get to this point. And it's really all perfect, because had I not struggled and kept looking and searching for the answer, and like you said, being inquisitive, then I wouldn't have found what I found, which was me.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and you're right. I mean, you have to be ready. And, you know, one of the lessons that I've learned in the last couple of years is, I don't even know what the lesson is, to be honest with you, but, you know, one of the biggest breakthroughs that I have had in my life, it wasn't about learning anything I didn't already know.
Right.
It was about looking at it differently. You know, there were all these events that took place in my life, and I've talked about them individually as ad nauseum over the years. But what I never did was like fly 1,000 feet above and look down on it and say, wow, I don't like the way that picture looks, you know, and feel that, you know?
Yes. Yes. So it was almost like you had to unlearn more than you had to actually attain more information.
Not almost. No, absolutely. And I think that's an important thing for us to realize too, is that when we talked about it. We talked about the adaptation that takes place in childhood. I mean, that's for survival, but we don't need that stuff in adulthood.
Right.
So it is about unlearning. It really is.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Leslie. I appreciate it. And I can't wait to get this out here so everybody can hear it. And I look forward to having you come back.
Part two.
The saga continues. All right. Have a good night. Thank you.
Tom, thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Just the product of some bad seeds.
All right, there you go, Leslie B. You can find out more about Leslie by following the links in the show notes. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave a review or a rating with Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you're not a subscriber, please do. Every little bit helps. Trying to build a community here. You can follow the show on Instagram or like us on Facebook, both at The Path to Authenticity. If you want to become a supporter of the show, you can find it on Patreon, patreon.com/The Path to Authenticity. By becoming a patron, you can gain access to some supplemental content as well as early access to episodes. All right, so another episode in the books. Got some great stuff coming up. Had a conversation with an old friend of mine yesterday, and I'm really, really hoping I can get him on the show. It was a treat. Someone I hadn't spoken to for a very long time who's very important to me. So, again, I hope you enjoyed the show. Share it with somebody. Tell somebody about it. This episode, any episode, the more the merrier. Thanks for listening. Keep coming back. Be nice. Thank you.
The path to authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.